And you are listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP. She's Denise.
Hello, everyone.
And I'm Johnny. And today we're in the studio with a guest who is Dom.
Hey, how's it going?
Going good. Thank you. Dom, why don't we just go ahead and kick it off? You can tell us a little bit about yourself, where you come from, and just a little bit of the rest of your story.
Well, I'm Dom, and I say now that I'm afflicted with recovery, and it started a long time ago. I'm 40 years old as of a week ago, and I was born and raised in Miami, Florida, and that was during the big cocaine boom, and that was a lot of fun, I hear. I was just a child then, so I wasn't quite fully involved with that, although, you know, I have some parents that thought that was pretty fun, and so I grew up in a rock and roll lifestyle. I went from Miami and moved around a lot, but down in Miami, there's a lot of different dynamics with that. That's why I'm in recovery today. And I started smoking marijuana when I was six. Started drinking alcohol and doing heavy drugs by the time I was 8 and 10 years old. 10 years old was a detrimental point for me. That's when I started injecting heroin and cocaine. And that sprung up to just 30 something years worth of a lot of addictions. And for me to come out of that, I had really had to look back underneath of what actually created me and how I became who the person that I am today. You know, at 6 years old, I had a house fire, and me and my family were almost killed during this. And that was the beginning of like all these different traumas that brought about these addictions and these false sense of security with the drugs. And you know, with addiction, there's usually typically a lot of different physical and emotional and mental abuse. So, you know, we leave Miami and we come up to Idaho, which is a huge culture shock. You know, you go from several hundred thousand people to, or even a million or more people to rural Idaho. Mm-hmm. And you hardly find people who are like you. But as time has progressed, I found a lot more people who are like me. And that, you know, that in finding these groups, you tend to see that your story is not just shared by you. I always say history is a mystery. His story is my story. Mm-hmm. And with that is always, you know, if you can share and befriend somebody who has a story similar to yours, you become closer with that person. But then again, you also know that you don't need to panic anymore. You don't need to regress to these old behaviors that keep you in that false sense of security and that addiction. And so, I was recently released from prison about a year ago, and I did about 3 years or so. And from that whole experience, I say I put myself in that situation, and I did. I actually waited for 6 hours for an officer to come and arrest me, and I had a bunch of drugs on me. I had a pistol, a 45, which 3 days prior to that, I tried to shoot myself with. And being caught with a firearm and drugs, they actually wanted to prosecute me for about 7 different felonies. Mm-hmm. And I was up a little down to just 2. And I got another one, the other one dropped because I was able to go into a specialty court, which was down in Idaho Falls. That's in Bonneville County. Mm-hmm. They have this a program called the Wood Pilot Project. And that it's an amazing.
Yeah, I was going to say, please tell us about it. Yeah. Tell us about what you experienced there, what you learned.
The project was produced and founded by Joanne Wood. Mm-hmm. And she's actually a representative in Idaho.
Excellent.
And she came about this program basically for people in recovery, people who are afflicted with mental health and addiction issues. Mm-hmm. But underneath all that, there's all this just a plethora, mm-hmm, of all these different factors and different variables that go, sure, into your addictions and into your mental health, for your overall well-being.
Right, and would you say lots of things to deal with, look at, work through, move forward?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think the counseling and being able to find these certain groups of people mm-hmm. is more detrimental. You know, mm-hmm. you have to have other people
right.
around you to help you.
You do.
More detrimental or more helpful?
Well, it's imperative, really.
Yeah,
okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It's detrimental if you don't.
Right, you don't find
that. Right, okay. Mm-hmm.
It is. So how long were you in that program?
I was in it for almost a year and a half.
Mm-hmm. And what types of classes did you take?
You take DBT, MRT, CSC. You do a group, which is actually led by an awesome man named, we all call him Dr. Dan. Mm-hmm. And he's an amazing, amazing person.
So CSC is cognitive self-change.
Yes, it is.
And what are some of those other ones?
The MRT is moral recognition therapy, mm-hmm. and the DBT is dialectic behavior therapy. Mm-hmm. I also say the DBT is deep breathing treatments, too.
Yeah, I was going to say dialectic.
It almost sounds like shock therapy.
So dialective. I think I'm pronouncing that right. What does that word mean?
Basically you have two truths to a situation.
Right.
So mm-hmm. you have one truth, which is, you know, your false sense of mm-hmm. security. Yep. And you have this other truth, which is the factors that begot mm-hmm. your addictions mm-hmm. and your behaviors. Mm-hmm. And so you work with both of those mm-hmm. and you put them together kind of like a sandwich and mm-hmm. you work on different skills like mindfulness mm-hmm. is a skill that you use during DBT, and you use like self-awareness, a lot of self-awareness and a lot of like responding and coping mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
So when you have triggers and urges, you're right. able to notice
right.
what triggers those and those urges, how those begin.
Right. So you can see them
right.
10 steps before.
Sometimes it's things you see, sometimes it's things mm-hmm. you smell, sometimes right. it's things that you hear or feel. Mm-hmm.
But you can start to recognize that before you hit the pattern that's going to lead you to
right,
go pick
before
up.
You start hitting that, mm-hmm. that, before yeah. you start hitting that downward spiral. Mm-hmm. So those are really important to be able to notice that.
It is.
So was that take it you successfully completed that program?
No, actually, I was removed from that program and sent to prison for the first time, mm-hmm. and I went and did that. And then I ended up getting out on probation, and I kind of messed up when I was on probation afterward. Mm-hmm. And so I went back to do some more of my time, and then they let me out on parole. So, okay.
So even the time, so you were in that program for a year and a half though, right?
Right.
So during that year and a half, even though you didn't graduate, you winded up really gaining a lot of knowledge is what it sounds like.
Oh, absolutely.
And a lot of healing.
Yeah. Oh, definitely a lot of healing. And that's the thing with the healing. It also brought up a lot of painful memories.
Sure.
The things that I had repressed. Mm-hmm. So when I was on, when I was in that program, there was little thoughts that had crossed my mind, little dreams that I would have. Mm-hmm. And goals, and I'm like, well, how can I get to these goals? Well, I have to work through the things that are preventing me from reaching these goals mm-hmm. first.
Right.
And so I utilize that to be able to basically dig down deep and find out what was really, what the problems were, what the issues mm-hmm. were, what the situations were that caused me to go into addiction deeper.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or some of these groups, like small groups, where the participants there came together, or did you just work on one-on-one with therapists or both?
Well, there's the one-on-one aspects, mm-hmm. and which is actually super, super important. Mm-hmm. That right there is, it's phenomenal to have somebody to sit and actually listen to you.
Sure.
Because a lot of people, even though we interact with each other, you have Facebook, Twitter, and all this other stuff, you don't have actual genuine interaction. Mm-hmm.
And I was going to say, I've heard a few times before where people have talked about in recovery that they over time built up trust with their counselor, that it was the time that they spent with them. It's not like they just knew them for a few months, but then over time of sharing their life with them, that seemed to help.
Right. You can form very meaningful relationships with somebody if you have that level of communication.
Right.
And so that level of honesty and persistence is really what generates a good human relationship.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the groups, yes, those are, the groups are, in general, they're decent size, you know, mm-hmm. you got 15 to 20 people mm-hmm. in a group. Mm-hmm. And sometimes for a lot of people that causes some anxiety and some sure. worry and stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you have a person in your group that is really worried about what other people are going to think, mm-hmm. if they're not there for their actual recovery, sure. you want to kind of pull them aside and make them a little more comfortable.
Sure.
You know, on a one-on-one basis.
So then it sounds like in that you were then around to be a lot of different, and not to say that you weren't already, but that you were in these groups and experiencing different types of personalities and their stories, and just kind of, you know, the world's opening up a little bit as far as what everyone else's life has looked like too, I'm guessing.
Right. You find a lot of common ground with, mm-hmm. with
yeah, your story and their story.
Right. That's yeah. why I say history is a mystery yeah. and his story is my story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, they're both kind of spelled the same and yeah. you know, it's the correlation between the two words.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I've had that experience. My experiences with, alcoholism and going through the AA program, which is, you know, prior to the time when, the science finally caught up and discovered, wow, you know, this is really, you know, this really is a, not just a failing of you know, people's ability mm-hmm. to cope. It's an actual physical rewiring of the brain, mm-hmm. and you know, they're gotten into doing things just really recently. I mean, it's only been probably the last 10 years where cognitive therapy and these other types of therapy mm-hmm. that you were correct. Describing. But when you get into the groups and in with other people and you start hearing their stories, for me, you know, early on, it's like, wow, these people are talking about stuff that I do not or have not yeah. Do not want to. And then as time went by, okay, maybe it's safe here mm-hmm. to talk about that stuff. And then, you know, you talk about the one-on-one time, well, the AA sponsor, I mean, that's mm-hmm. what that's all about. You get that one-on-one time with somebody who's been through it, which is an advantage most MDs and psychologists, PhDs don't get that. Well, more and more are, but
right.
But for the most part,
hearing about it,
you know, they haven't lived the dream, as I like to call it.
Correct, right.
And so they have trouble relating on certain levels with what we're going through when we're in recovery. Not that what they do is not important or, you know, useful or, you know, beneficial.
It has a purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got real purpose and it is real helpful. I mean, you yourself, you know, that one-on-one time you spent with the, you know, Dr. Dan, that's you know, invaluable part of the process. And that's the important, you know, or something that, you know, I like to let people know who, you know, are either thinking about getting into recovery or new into recovery or family members that, you know, would just love somebody to get into recovery mm-hmm. is that, you know, it's not an alone thing.
No, it's definitely, you know, a community group effort kind of yeah, thing. You need lots of support and resources and things like that for sure.
That's right.
And I feel like more and more doctors are hearing about recovery and what it takes. And so they're encouraging it. I know that my doctor, you know, encourages those kinds of things and understands more about it. So it's happening. It's definitely not maybe like the general norm, but it's starting to happen because we're talking about it a lot and sharing
right.
it.
Right,
and that's where the dynamics of the human relationship, which I was yeah. mentioning earlier, that's why that's so important. Mm-hmm. Because if right. you don't have that human contact, if you don't have that information from somebody else, because right. from somebody else's experience, you can definitely learn. That's the model that we learn after mm-hmm. is somebody else's experience. Most of the thoughts and most of your feelings are not just the original. Other people have right. suffered that before.
Yes.
And so being able to follow through with that and be able to learn what those coping mechanisms are that work for you individually, mm-hmm. that's what's most important.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Healthy
and,
ones.
Yeah, I think you've probably been at this long enough. I mean, prison is a horrible place to, you know, get sober.
Well, it's not a place to go make friends and stuff. But then you do formulate relationships there
right,
that
exactly.
are good, and they can become lasting friendships because doing time with somebody, you get to really know in that situation you're yeah. the most humble and the most simplistic person that you can be at that point.
Right.
And you really get to learn a lot about an individual when you're in a situation like mm-hmm. that.
Right, because the you know, a facade only lasts
it doesn't
so
last
long.
That long there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like if somebody can pull it off, I'd grant them whatever being that they can be, but you know, you're going to end up being either following somebody or becoming a leader there.
Right.
And
right.
So that's where that whole dynamic of going to prison is actually kind of important. I found that actually a therapeutic community for me. Mm-hmm. Because there was a lot of people that shared the same similar background as I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you get hooked on heroin, you know, you go and you're living a lifestyle that, you know, it's going to kill you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In the end, it's going to kill you.
One way or another.
It changes your brain and make your decisions.
And the chemical mm-hmm. compounds of it. And the same thing with alcohol.
Right.
That will kill you even quicker, you know. Tobacco, that's mm-hmm. I consider that a drug as well.
Yeah.
Sure.
And nicotine, so that's probably the worst thing that I've ever started that I have not been able to quit yet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I had a 3-year period before that I wasn't incarcerated or anything else that I just quit smoking because mm-hmm. I was doing myself a little experiment. Me and my now ex-wife, we did this experiment to see how much money we would save.
Oh,
right.
We saved $3,600 in just a few months period.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, right. And it's a coping mechanism that's just an unhealthy one. I mean... You know, in my opinion, you know, I mean,
right.
I will just own it real quick to the listening audience. I'm currently a smoker again. I'd quit for 8 months, but
dun, dun, dun.
I know the guilt anyways, but the story's not over yet on that one.
Yeah. We'll talk to you through a stoma later on.
Yeah. Something. I'm going to figure out something. We're working on it. Cause I don't want to be smelling like an ashtray for
no, no, it's a horrible thing. That's the thing. As a kid, I despised it. I really did.
Yeah.
But then it became a mechanism, a coping mechanism for me so that I wasn't having the urge to go do harder drugs.
Yeah.
Gee, I just started to be cool. I guess I missed out on everything.
Yeah, you know, actually, that was the original.
All these good reasons.
That was the original reason. My best friend.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, my best friend smoked. I think we were about 13. And so, you know, anything that had to do with being cool like her was pretty much all go, you know. So thank God she didn't have any other crazy habits.
Right, because you can pick those up really quick because that's a very formative age.
Yeah, it is.
You know, that's where we become mm-hmm. the adults that we are.
Mm-hmm.
That's really kind of funny. I actually started smoking marijuana before I started smoking cigarettes. Oh. I started smoking cigarettes to cover up the smell of smoking marijuana.
That's exactly how I did it too.
Yeah, it's.
I was a late bloomer. I was in my late 20s before I did any of that kind of stuff. But
well, that's all right. There's.
I was busy running and having boy problems. So.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, bummer. Yeah, I'm glad I don't have that problem.
Me, I'm with you there too. You know, although you
that
know,
was
given,
my
given enough time,
with, you know,
yeah,
that's why.
Well,
know.
Men and women are definitely different,
different
and so we have to take a pause and like notice the differences, I suppose. So because we can't expect that they're going to be like us. So.
Absolutely not. I was raised by my mom and my three sisters, and I was like 13 before I knew I could stand up to urinate. So I grew up with a lot of those, you know.
Right.
She doesn't like me anymore, you know.
Sister's
like, oh, come here, let's hug it out.
Geez, is that where my imbalance came from with that whole being like all too codependent on what boys thought about me when I was younger? It was because my dad wasn't around. My dad passed away when I was 7, so it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't intentional or anything like that. But I really do look back at that and go, man. The minute that man was out of the house, you know, it's like, you know.
Got to find a replacement.
Yeah.
Got to find that male figure. But.
So, that's how I ended up in recovery, though, is because I did have the missing parent in my life for a lot of years.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I began formulating the plan to get into trouble and put into a treatment program,
mm-hmm.
I thought that was genius. I was like, oh, yeah, that's the smartest thing I could do. But now I look back and I'm like, wow, now my record is going to reflect on the fact that I was arrested and charged with a felony. But throughout all of it, it created a healthier, more sane person within me.
Sure, and I get that. So what were your experiences? Did you try to – was there a point in time before that, before you were thinking, well, I have to get in trouble to get help? Because I understand that, you know, there are certain programs where you do have to get in trouble to get help. Were there, what kind of steps or information were you trying to find out, like Was there anything you tried to do that was unsuccessful that you couldn't get help with?
Well, the few things that... So,
my long-winded question, sorry.
No, and I completely understand it, too, as well. The things that I tried before were just saying, okay, no, I'm going to be done. And then a few days to a week to a few months would go by where I'd feel like I'm fine. And then all of a sudden that urge or something would trigger, you know, these things. And... Sometimes it would be a kid crying, at the store or something, and it would just trigger it off.
Yeah, and I totally get that.
And so when I began to treat it as something that I needed to seek help with, you know, I tried talking to family first. I tried talking to friends, and I started to realize that this is something I couldn't just tackle on my own.
Sure.
It's something that, you know, if I was going to try and run through it, I would run through a few walls first.
Yeah.
And then I would hit the final really thick brick wall, which would stop me.
Yeah.
And so what I did was I got a hold of the State Department, actually down in Idaho Falls, and I was going to a free counselor, which I thought was just phenomenal. I thought that was the greatest thing. And so I started to kind of open up some old wounds.
Sure.
And be able to really process what some of the problems were before I had gotten in trouble, before I had, you know, and all I was doing is just, I was clawing at the ground that was giving way, you know? And so I started with this counselor, and on the sixth time that I went to him, he looks at me as I walk into his office, and he goes, "Well, Mr. Crespo, you have exhausted all your free six visits, and in order to get the help that you need or want, you're either going to need to be incarcerated, court-ordered, or have the money for treatment." And I was like, "Well, how much is that going to cost?" You know, because at the time I was making pretty good money, you know, I was working a lot and everything else, but I realized I had all these issues that I needed to contend with.
Sure.
And he's like, "Well, that's going to be like $3,800 or $38,000," and I was like, "There's no way, absolutely no way I'll be able to come up with that."
Sure.
And I couldn't even ask my family for that at that point. And I'm sure looking back now, I'm sure they would have taken some time and actually thought it through and said, okay, well, this would have been better than you having this possession charge on your record.
Sure.
But I look at it now, and if it wasn't for this entire experience, it would have been one of those goals that I was never able to complete.
Right.
And so, you know, going to the counselor and having him say that, that's what helped me actually formulate that plan. I'm saying, hey, I'm just going to get arrested with some drugs on me, and I'm going to go get treatment.
Right, and that's kind of the thing, and that's why, like, the Latell Recovery Center, this radio show, we're an outreach of the Latell Recovery Center, and it's why it's so important that we get word out to the community, that we share our stories about the different kinds of places that you can go to get help and stuff like that, because, you know, there are places to get help in Musco without getting trouble, and yes, exactly. And there is some help financially, although I don't, you know, it's not always the case. It's not always, it doesn't always happen.
That's
what we're rooting for, to be able to happen.
Tends to be, dependent on your situation. If you're actively in addiction, then one of the, unfortunately, big deals is you got to be, a current IV drug user.
Right.
And unfortunately, for most current IV drug users,
they don't want
getting help is not on, not at the top of the list. Yeah. Right.
It scares them. They, you know, because they have that sense of paranoia, is that if they come to somebody for help, they're going to end up in trouble.
Right.
And because of their addiction, it's so ingrained in them that they're going to be paranoid and not want to get that help, even though they really want the help.
Because
they're not going to take that route to get it.
Right.
Because they'd be afraid they would get incarcerated, and then they know for sure the door's shut on their drugs.
Right.
And I totally understand that. I mean, I ran as long as I could before I got in trouble.
And sometimes that's your saving grace.
Oh, it was my saving grace. You know, absolutely.
That is your saving grace.
For everyone around me as well.
Right.
Absolutely.
You know, after losing so many family members and so many friends to the addictive world, to make the decision for myself to be sober and clean, you know, and now I have an old lady right now that she has been just an absolute pillar for me.
That's great.
You know, and she went through some rough stuff with me in the beginning, you know, because at that point I kind of was still using. And I just told her, and she's asked me, why? Why would you continue to do this if you know that I'm going to leave?
Right.
And I go, because that's what they all do. You get into a relationship with somebody and they don't agree with your lifestyle, they leave. That's a healthy choice. And so, you know, for me, that, you know, having her say, I'm not going to leave you. you know, because everybody else in my life has.
Right, abandonment issues.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's why the whole process, you know, you go to a processing group, mm-hmm. and you're able to speak about these things and talk right. about these things and get decent feedback.
Sure.
That's right there is what's, it's imperative that you go and look for these things. Mm-hmm. Because if you catch it early enough, you won't have to go be incarcerated. You won't yeah. have to live a life, or you won't have to go right. to, you know, get a doctor and have your Hep C treatments, mm-hmm. or, you know, you run a lot of risk living that life.
Yes.
And I feel very fortunate that, you know, I'm still mm-hmm. disease free.
Yeah.
I'm mentally and emotionally more stable now. Mm-hmm. I have great family and friends now, you know, and it's been only just a few years. But for me to come this far from where I was at before, mm-hmm. you know, it's emotional. It really mm-hmm. is, you know, because I come from a point where, you know, that I was hopeless and helpless and I had nowhere to go except for down.
Right.
And so I decided to grab onto those rungs of the ladder that I started to build, mm-hmm. you know, take these stepping stones, all the rocks that were holding me down, I'd stack them up and use them as a ladder to get out. Mm-hmm. You know, that and there's a lot of different analogies and a lot of different different systems that you can use. So I urge each and every person that does hear my story, that I do tell it to, I urge them desperately to search for those. So just find one little goal and work on that until you complete it.
Yeah, you can walk through one door, like the Lakeville Recovery Center, or, you know, AANA.
All those other A's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Weeks and Vitry.
Weeks and Vitry is an excellent place.
It really
you
is.
Know, they're a little short staffed at the time, but
can't help
you know,
it.
But I like them. You know.
Yeah, shameless promotion. We do it. That's okay.
I'll
name drop that all day.
Yeah, totally. So, you know, I mean, that place saved my life. So.
Yeah, the treatment staff down in Idaho Falls, you know, I formulated friendships with them. In fact, I was friends with some of them before they became treatment staff mm-hmm. down there.
Right.
Even some of the officers and everything yep. else. And so to see them from where they were before to the people that they are today, that mm-hmm. it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Like well, that is a miracle.
Yeah. There's
and up here a couple of just a few weeks yeah. ago when Judge Stegner. John Stegner had to leave the bench here to go serve on the Idaho State Supreme Court.
Yes, he did.
They had a going away party.
We had
for
a graduation
him.
Party for
graduation
him.
Graduation party that was greatly attended mm-hmm. by people he put in jail
yep.
and in programs. Mm-hmm. And you know if
that's gonna
any
be such
if
a
anybody
for him, you know,
yeah, was, if anybody out there, you know, mm-hmm. you know is frightened of the potential of going in front of a judge, you know, sometimes miracles happen.
They do,
despite what you might think.
Yeah.
Hey, why don't we take a little break here, get a drink of water,
sure.
and listen to a little music, and
all right.
We'll come back to this in a minute
music.
And talk a little more with Dom.
You're listening to KRFP, Moscow Pullman, Recovery Radio.
Recovery.
Sing a song. If the sun reveals a shine, I don't mind. If the mountains fill in the sea, let it be, can be me. Conservative flashing down the street, pointing their plastic finger at me.
You're pursuing my kind of drop and dive. I'm gonna wave my free flag. Just don't fall on me. Right on, Mr. Businessman. You can't dress like me. It's time for me to die. So let me live my life the way I want to. Yeah. Sing on, brother. Play on.
Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I'm Johnny, she's Denise, and he's Don.
Domo.
Dom is our guest on the show today.
He is. He is our special guest. Well, they're all special. Not short bus special, just special.
Hey, just living and loving it, man.
Yeah.
There you go. Now, Dom, when we broke away, something that popped in my head that kind of piqued my interest was you were talking a lot about... people typically recognize addiction by, you know, red eyes, slurred speech, a plethora of bad decision making. It's really important, and you touched on it a little bit, that it's not so much looking at a person and asking what's wrong with you, but a more important question is what happened to you. And maybe tell us a little bit about some of those things that you worked out that were, we'll call them ghosts from the past that you've discovered helped lead you down, you know, those things that made you want to deal with that pain badly.
Wow, that's really good because the fact that I did touch on it a little bit, there was a little bit of fear with that because there's some things that, you know, some people want to talk about and some people don't.
Right.
And with me, since I've discovered and was able to unearth these repressed memories and these repressed issues and these situations that had happened, I was able to formulate why I am and how I became so strong. You know, because when, you know, being in an addiction, you consider yourself weak and pointless and worthless. And to be able to make it through some of the things that we make it through as addicts, something does happen to you either at a young age or even at an older age that triggers that response. Mm-hmm. And psychologically, when you go through these situations, like, okay, so at 6 years old, I had a house fire. I've been through a hurricane. I've been through two hurricanes. I have been in several car accidents. I was physically, emotionally, and verbally abused as a kid, and also sexually abused. And I've been blown up. I've been stabbed, been shot at. And all these things weren't just from my addictive lifestyle. These were things that happened within, you know, family dynamics, within, you know, social situations. You know, you go to a party and something bad happens there, you know, and then you're all of a sudden you're like, wow, how did I get in the middle of this? Mm-hmm. Right. How did I become the target? And so as a kid, that's how I always saw myself, is as a target. Mm-hmm. Somebody was always out to get me, you know, whether it be, you know, a babysitter. You know, when I was pretty young, I was raped and molested by a male babysitter repeatedly for a few years, and that was a big hit. You know, being able, yeah, to remember that and actually just remember the smells and the feelings and the sensation that, am I not good enough? You know, and it was a very shameful thing to think about and to talk about at first, but now it's something that I found strength in, that because, you know, I can say, oh yeah, I'm a survivor. Mm-hmm. But I also look at it like, you know, I made it through that. So I can take what I learned from that lesson and say, you know, I learned from this.
Well, it wasn't your fault.
And that's the biggest point, right, is that you got to realize that some of these things aren't your fault. Yeah. Even though you can look at it and say, oh, well, you know, I let this happen.
Yeah, I didn't resist enough. I didn't.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Like, why didn't I fight back? Or why didn't I do this?
Probably trying, you know, to survive.
And right, that's the thing. When you have that survivor instinct, you know, and I can thank my mom for that. You know, we went through a lot together. But we also, she showed me so many, you know, what true grit and strength was. Mm-hmm. You know, she was a single mom raising three kids. She had multiple jobs, mm-hmm, and she still went out and partied. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I learned how to be very resourceful, mm-hmm, and very adaptive. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm, there's times that, you know, I didn't see my mom for a week or two sometimes. You know, there's this one experience that I had when I was a kid. Me and my brother and my sister, we were dropped off, and we were at this strange person's house for like almost 2.5-3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And finally they're like, look, you know, we're running out of food. We don't know who the hell you guys are. Mm-hmm. Where do you live? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, we live, I think, that way. And I remembered us driving through. We came through Palouse, Pullman, Moscow, went through Derry and Troy, and at the time we lived in Helmer. Mm-hmm. And so, because we went from Miami to Spokane, and we stayed, mm-hmm, in Spokane for a few months, and then we went to Helmer, Idaho. You know, so, right, that's a huge
yeah,
cultural transition. You know, and that was almost devastating. Mm-hmm. You know, because we went from being surrounded by people who actually were, you know, because down in Miami you have your neighborhood. Your neighborhood is basically the community, and you all take care of each other. Mm-hmm. You know, you walk down the street, if you're hungry, you just go up to somebody's door and be like, hey, you know, I want, you know, right, y'all eating?
Y'all know each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know each other. You just go up there and they say, come on in, have some food.
Well, and it's familiar. It's familiar. Even the surroundings are familiar. I mean, you know what you know.
Right. And if you're going to go to your neighbor's house in Helmer, that's about a 20-minute walk.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. You know, we lived out on Old Bear Creek Road and at the Y. Instead of going to where the bridge is at and where the swimming hole is, you know, you hang a right and you just go up there. You know, and so the only friends that I had were at school.
Yeah.
And right. So as a kid, because of sometimes the home life was scary. You know, and without a father, you know, that's the thing is a lot of times I replaced him, you know, and it ended up being, you know, me helping raise my brother and sister pretty much by myself. And I say helping because, you know, my mom would come and she'd make sure that there was food in the fridge at times, but then there was times that there wasn't.
You became an adult.
Way too early.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, that's when I started to, you know, say, hey, you know, just being out in the woods is, it's peaceful, it's nice, but then again, something happens to you, you're alone.
Yeah, it's really lonely.
So then that probably triggered some stuff too, because it sounds to me like, you know, with all the different kinds of things happened, that fear and, you know, lack of safety was...
It was a huge issue for me. Huge.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so then I became more self-reliant.
Mm-hmm.
And that right there started to help me, you know, because my mom showing me how reliant she was, you know, and there's an issue of codependency there.
Sure.
You know.
Right. She's your only one you got.
Basically, yeah.
Right.
And so me and my brother and my sister, we formulated great relationships, you know, and, you know, we kind of made a pact with each other saying, you know, hey, we're not going to grow up and be like that.
Right.
But me being the oldest, I went off and pretty much did the same thing, you know, and
well, that's not too unusual.
I came
from a long line of alcoholics, and you know, I learned how to drink and party from my parents.
Right.
You know, not that I had any intent to do that, but you know, this is when you drank alcohol, this is what you do.
Right.
I mean, it's right there in front of you all the time, you know. Right.
So that's a model that you can copy.
Yeah, and the first time I got drunk, you know, blackout drunk at, you know, 8 years old, I didn't suffer any consequences at home. They thought it was hysterical.
Right.
You know, once I got over the hangover, I can remember my father giving me, it was Christmas morning, and I'm hung over for the first time ever, and just, oh God, you know, praying for death to come and take me, you know, and my father giving me some eggnog with brandy in it, and just the smell of the alcohol was like, and my sister leans over and she goes, just drink it, you'll feel better. Right. And I'm looking at her like, how do you know, you know, she was, I don't know, 14 or 15 years old at the time. Wow. And by God, I drank it and I felt better. And, you know, right. Christmas was okay.
Dang,
after
I thought
that,
you were going to say some ibuprofen.
Oh no. That hadn't been invented yet.
Right.
Aspirin was a miracle drug in those days.
Okay. All right. You take it for everything. Your head cuts off, you know, just put some aspirin on it.
That's
all right.
Rub some dirt on it, walk it off, you'll be fine.
Right.
So you're going to have that limp for a while.
Get some baling twine, you're fine.
That's right. Duct tape.
As I get out Neosporin and a Band-Aid and, you know, hydrogen peroxide for every little owie that any of us has at home. Well, me and my girls anyways, you know.
Don't you use spit anymore?
No.
Spit on it and wipe it off?
I don't have anything to do with spit. My girls went through a little phase of like spitting at each other or whatever.
Nice.
I was like, I'm like a quarter Italian, and that's like a bad word. We don't do that. Yeah, it is. And that's what I told them. I'm like, that's worse than the worst thing you could say. I'm like, so you can't do that around me at all. Anyway, sorry.
Yes. Yeah, but let's not go too far down the child abuse trail.
Right.
So anyway, Don. Yeah. So you discovered, you know, some of these things. It came up in going through the counseling and do you think that was like one of the most significant things that helped you?
It was definitely a good turning point for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that's the thing, is I was able to establish the what wins and where, the what mm-hmm. wins and whys, you know, and mm-hmm. for that to be able to form, to discuss and understand, you know, the why was I doing this? Oh, where did mm-hmm. this happen, and why did it happen? You know, to ask myself these questions, because sometimes you can't go back. You know, because like in AA, you have mm-hmm. the 12 steps.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that system was developed in the 50s. Mm-hmm. You know,
30s.
In the 30s, yeah. Oh, it was in yeah. the 30s, 30s when it first yeah. started.
Right,
you know, Dr. Bill, he
Dr. started, Bob and Bill, yeah,
yeah.
I Bill mean,
w, it, they started that years and years and years ago, and that was the pioneering standpoint of where our recovery today is has gotten from.
Right, you know? Exactly, and they didn't even, you know, they didn't really look at it in the way that we're capable of now with, mm-hmm. you know, looking at those things that happened, you know, right. in our youth that, you know, helped push us towards it. Things that are triggered, they focus primarily on, you know, the here and now, you know, being right. present, you know, being of service, and, you know, helping other people, you know, to achieve sobriety and maintain sobriety. All those things help heal those wounds and things that we all have, you know, that closet full of demons that we all deal with, but they never specifically address that as a, you know, methodology of helping to you know, build sobriety, to build healthy thought, to which lets you you know, pursue sobriety and a sober lifestyle, you know, in the most healthy manner. It, basically, what I'm saying is we're just getting better at it.
Yeah,
I mean, the 12 steps and the traditions, it's all real important basic stuff, but it doesn't mean that we can't do better. Even in the big book, they talk about, you know, listen, you know, even if you're not a religious person, listen to people who have, you know, religious convictions, because there's good information there. Mm-hmm. You know, there might yeah. be something you can use, even if you don't want to.
You know, you can establish a belief system within yourself,
right?
Utilizing that, because you can take that understanding, the understanding of a higher power, whether it be you know, your mind or somebody else's.
Right.
You can formulate a complex formula, like an algorithm almost,
mm-hmm.
and say, this is what we're gonna do. And this is how we're going to figure this out. And you can work together with somebody else on that. And that's right. why I was kind of mentioning the whole childhood thing, is because if you don't establish a good, healthy relationship, even as a child,
right,
there's a higher chance that statistically that you're going to end yeah. up in a situation such as ours.
Right. Exactly.
You know? And so this is, that's why, you know, I tend to formulate friendships and, or at least an association with younger people. At times, you know, I become, you know, I ask them pertinent questions, you know, are you okay? How are you doing today?
Right.
How's school going?
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, that's how I used to, that was my safe zone, was going to school. Because mm-hmm. that's where I had access to books. That's where I had access to other people that were my age,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so.
And safe adults.
And safer adults, yes.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, so I you know, I like to say that I became really good friends with a couple of my teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left school early. And so, I can say I always regret it, but it wouldn't have given me the experience and wouldn't help create those situations that I've been through and lived through thus far mm-hmm. to be able to be this person that I am today.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, and my teachers were really upset when I left. You know, they actually, all the three of them that were really close to me, that I was close with, was my science teacher, my English teacher, and
it's like they became your family. They're your extended family.
And
you know?
The funny thing is, though, is they were actually family friends of ours.
Yeah, I mean.
And so, you know,
yeah.
I was at Troy High School, you know, mm-hmm. and if anybody knew who Tom Flake is, Ron Goble, and Warren Case are, you know, they are three of the awesomest teachers that I've ever had. And still today, you know, I wonder where they're at in life. And, you know, I would like to go see them,
mm-hmm.
you know, and and just tell them, you know what? I told them at the time that they were wrong for saying that, I wasn't going to go anywhere, you know, that, that I was making a bad choice. And I look back now and I was like, you know, just graduating high school would have helped me progress so much faster and so much easier. Mm-hmm. But at the time, my thought process was, you guys don't have any more to teach me.
Well, you made the best choice that you could, that at, the time. Exactly. And then, you know, and then life goes on from there.
Home, that's, what, that's why I left, is to leave home.
Right. And it's hard to say what would have happened if you didn't. So, I mean,
right.
That's kind of where, you know, like, you might look back and say, well, I mean, was or wasn't a good choice, but who knows? You know what I mean? As long as you just keep going forward with stuff, you know.
And that's the thing, that, you know, going forward is part of that. That's why, you know, I want to catch the younger generations, mm-hmm. and kind of, you know, help aid them with their lives and whatever struggles they have. Right. You know, because if they don't have anybody to role model after, you know, I'm not just going to say that I'm the best role model,
well,
but
even if
the
no
experiences
one's,
that I have, somebody, yeah. if so they have somebody to listen,
yeah.
and to help them.
That's what I'm saying. If well, no one's asking the question around them,
you got to be able to keep it. You got to be able to give it away. To
exactly.
keep it.
Yeah, you know, and until you have it, there's nothing you can give.
And I absolutely understand, you know, the desire and the want to save somebody, you know, that 20 years of misery that you know, I had to go through,
right.
before, you know, the light bulb finally came on, before I, you know, had to get so incredibly desperate. You know, I hit bottom so many times, and I used to say, yeah, and then some a-hole would throw me a shovel, you know.
Right.
It was me all the time,
right,
of course.
Time.
But, you know, having, you know, being there, helping somebody else, that's, yeah, that probably does more for my sobriety than anything else. You know, come showing up here every Thursday at 12:30 and you know, getting people on the air, talking about their program and talking with Denise and her and I, sometimes just going back and forth. That really helps me stay sober, at least for today.
Yeah, me too.
And that's a good decision to make, you know, because like I said, without having those relationships, you know, with people who have been and had that experience and had been in that life, it, you know, it's hard to associate with that.
Right,
you know, because you
exactly.
have that disassociation factor where like you're always going to question, do you really understand what I'm saying to you, or how
right.
I feel at the moment?
Right.
You know, unless somebody's been through it. And those of us with addictions, we're like a big family.
Right, exactly.
Especially those of us who started our recovery. You know, even the ones that are still in there and in full-on addiction, they still are family to us because of the simple fact that they have been and they're going through the same things that we've already experienced.
Exactly.
So it's for them to continue to repeat that pattern, and for us to be in recovery, what we've done is we broke that chain and we've become somebody that they can look at and say, hey, maybe I want to be like you.
Right. Setting
you
that
go.
Example and sharing this story.
And that's a good note to end on. So I want to thank you, Don, for
yes,
coming
you.
In
you
and sharing
so
your story today. It was awesome. And thank you, Denise, for keeping the ball rolling, as always.
Thanks.
And not spitting on me. Appreciate
right.
that.
Gosh, that'll never happen.
And you've been listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP in beautiful Moscow, Idaho.
Beautiful.
And we are out.
Told you about living in the U.S. of A. Don't you know that I'm a gangster of love? Let me tell you people that I found a new way. And I'm tired of all this talk about love. And the same old story with a new set of words. About the good and the bad and the poor. And the times keep on changing, so I'm keeping on top of every bad cat who walks through my door. I'm a slave.